What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point to counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forget the current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyers in the house.
Welcome to Legal Face Off. I have Rich Lenkov standing by. I'm Craig Collins sitting in for Sam Penianovich. And we kick off the show with a whole bunch of guests, which
no
is very
Jason
exciting
today.
For me.
No
Jason Whiteside.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't see Jason.
Solo.
And nice. Is that a plan for you moving forward? Are you going to release your own album with just your first name or something?
Yes. So this is the beginning of my solo career.
We have a lot of voices on the phone. We have Renato Mariotti, who is a partner at Thompson & Coburn. Thank you for joining us, Renato.
Thank you.
We have Patrick on the line, who is a partner at Greensfelder, Hempker, and Gale. Thank you for joining us, Patrick.
Good to be here.
And then finally, we have Andrew DeVote, who's from Loeb & Loeb. He's a partner at Loeb & Loeb. Thank you for joining us, Andrew.
Great to be here.
Right, thanks, now, everyone. So this is our all-star
introduction.
Former federal prosecutor panel. The most important part of your extensive bio is you're all incredibly well-qualified and have long resumes. But the reason we're having you on today is to talk about Trump, given your prior experience in the U.S. attorney's offices across the country. So let's start off with Andy, who's a return guest on Legal Face-Off. Trump has been accused of obstruction of justice. Simply put, do you think that Robert Mueller will be able to prove the necessary elements of obstruction of justice or any of the other committees looking at the president?
I mean, whether or not he'll be able to succinctly, it's hard to say at this point. But I think if of all of those that you mentioned, I think he's best positioned to. You have someone who has been the director of the FBI under a Republican and Democratic president, someone who himself has been the U.S. attorney in the Northern District of California and in Massachusetts, someone who is widely respected. And although he doesn't have the full discretion of an independent counsel, a special counsel, he does have the day-to-day discretion. He certainly has the experience. He knows what to look for. So I think of all of those groups, I think if anyone will, it will be Robert Mueller.
Patrick, you are, again, a former federal prosecutor. You're a longtime white-collar defense attorney at Greensfelder. We heard over the last couple of days news about Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, who now, it appears, will not testify, will invoke his right against self-incrimination and not testify before the House or Senate. If you were his attorney, would you advise him to do that?
I would advise him not to testify. Yes, I would.
Why is that?
I think that, well, because the accusations include accusations of committing perjury and making false statements to government officials. Those are crimes. And I think I would not want my client being grilled about whether or not he committed crimes if I had any concerns that anything he might say could possibly in any way aid a prosecution of him, whether he's guilty or not. I mean, the Fifth is available to anybody. And it doesn't mean you're guilty of anything, of course, but it does mean you don't have to help the government put together a case against you.
Actually, can I jump in on this and mention something? You know, one thing that I find interesting, this is Renato Mariotti, I have heard reports that Mr. Flynn is actually planning to invoke the Fifth or will invoke the Fifth as to the production of documents, which is very interesting because what that means is his attorney is essentially indicating that they believe that the mere act of producing the documents would itself incriminate Mr. Flynn. And that's, you know, something that doesn't happen as often as invoking the Fifth as to testimony. And what it suggests is that, at the very least, there are documents in Mr. Flynn's possession that would intend to incriminate him.
What kind of documents
well,
do you think?
Well, I would just to clarify that, I'm not sure we can leap to that assumption, Renato. It may be that he believes, or his attorney believes, some of those documents are not subject to subpoena because they're personal and not business records. They may be things that he feels simply don't fall under the ability of the government to force him to turn over.
But so, why would you take the Fifth then, as opposed to just refusing to comply with the subpoena?
Well, he may take the position that they're testimonial, and that therefore they're the same thing as asking him to testify. So he's I don't know. I mean, we're all speculating. His attorney hasn't explained his reasoning. But I'm just pointing out there's multiple grounds upon which he might oppose turning over documents.
Let's turn back. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just to clarify, and both guys are making great points, but just to clarify for your listeners, and so obviously the Fifth Amendment right is unequivocal with respect to your testimony, but what these guys are pointing to is a more nuanced point with the documents, as they alluded to. And just because the fact that the content of documents are incriminating doesn't necessarily give you a Fifth Amendment right to not produce them. As Renato alluded to, it's when you're asserting that just the mere production, so you're basically confirming the existence of documents perhaps they didn't know existed. So it's a more nuanced point than the testimonial point. And it's one that if the government, you can end up in this back and forth with the government. If the government is aware of the existence of those documents, then perhaps that what is called the active production invocation of the Fifth Amendment, it may not exist. So there's going to be a lot of back and forth here, I think, on this more nuanced point.
So let's get back to Trump, because we had, you know, we had Alan Dershowitz on last week, who was very vociferous in his defense of Trump, even though he's not a Trump defender, even though he said he wasn't a Trump voter. He was very adamant in that by firing Comey, Trump did not exhibit the requisite mens rea, the requisite intent to adhere to the obstruction of justice standard. If you were prosecuting this kind of case, you're all former federal prosecutors, how difficult do you think it would be to prove intent, given that ultimately I think we all know that this is how Trump talks? And the big question is going to be, is this just the way Trump talks when he calls someone a nut job or when he fires someone? Or is that evidence of the necessary intent to meet the obstruction of justice standard? Renato, what do you think?
Well, it's obviously early. We don't have a lot of information. But what I would say is it's always difficult to prove intent beyond a reasonable doubt, ever. Any prosecutor will tell you that proving the requisite intent is often the most difficult part of any case, particularly a case where there's not direct evidence, like an intent is part of that. Unless somebody actually writes down on a sheet of paper or tells somebody, I plan to do this or I want to do this or I'm doing this for that reason, it's often very difficult to prove intent. So, you know, while I don't have any idea of the specifics of all the evidence that's out there, obviously none of us in the public do, I'm skeptical of whether I'm skeptical that there will ultimately be a case that proves the president's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, just because a president has never been, on the receiving end of criminal charges, a sitting president, and it's often very difficult to prove that. That said, I think that what Mr. Dershowitz said in the prior episode was a disservice to your viewers or your listeners. And the reason I say that is it's clear from at least what we've heard that if some of these reports are true, that the president at the very least has gotten himself mixed up in an obstruction probe and has some criminal exposure, or at the very least there's an appearance that he may have engaged in criminal activity. So to dismiss out of hand the possibility that he could be ultimately facing some obstruction charge, I think is foolish and not appropriate.
Patrick, agree, disagree?
Oh, I agree, but I also think that I would say, we've all done it, I'm sure. I've prosecuted people, and I've proven intent without, you know, a signed note saying this is what I intend. You can prove intent by actions. You can prove intent by context. So I think that while it's very early days, and nobody, including Alan Dershowitz, should be prejudging this case one way or the other, but I do think that if you look at Mr. Comey's situation, we already know some facts which may shed light on his intent, because not only is there the allegation that he said, you know, I sure hope you can let this Flynn thing go, but he then later said, I got rid of him because of the Russian thing, i.e. the investigation, and then he fired him. So those are acts. Those are evidence. That's pieces of evidence you could, if you were prosecuting that case someday, show a jury and say, if you want to know what Mr. Trump meant when he said what he said to Mr. Comey, look at what he did. It's consistent with, you would argue, it's consistent with an intent to interfere with justice. Now, I'm not prejudging it. It is way early, as Renato and everybody has said, but I do think that intent is something that can be proven by context.
And I don't disagree, by the way, with Pat on that point. And I actually, another piece of context would be the president allegedly dismissing the vice president and the attorney general from the room before making those comments to Mr. Comey, which if that was something that he did not do on a regular basis, would potentially suggest that he thought that what he was saying was something he did not want others to witness. One could draw that inference. So I agree with Pat that you can certainly prove intent through circumstantial evidence. I'm just trying to give your listeners the sense of the fact that that can be a challenge. So,
Andy, let's shift really quickly to a topic that we've covered extensively that you've talked to us about on Legal Faceoff, the never-ending saga of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who on Friday petitioned the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to rehear his case. He has unsuccessfully tried to have his case heard on a couple of occasions, including the Supreme Court. My question to you is, as a former federal prosecutor, do you think the Circuit Court of Appeals will decide to rehear this case? And ultimately, do you think the Supreme Court will hear it? They refused to hear it last year. And do you think Trump will pardon him? I mean, he was a successful contestant on the Celebrity Apprentice. So what do you think the chances of Blago getting out early are?
Well, first of all, I just have to, on your last question, I'm excited for Robert Mueller to be here because we can't have this issue decided by the Washington Post and the New York Times, and I'm tired of, I look forward to someone actually gathering the facts as opposed to unconfirmed sources from those two media outlets, so I'm looking forward to that. On that issue, I think
Fox News.
Oh, there you go. There you go. They report it, and then your listeners can decide, but
fair
I think the Seventh Circuit will not rehear the case. And the Supreme Court will definitely not rehear the case, despite also being a fan of a fashionable hairstyle. I think that the president will not pardon former Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Well, guys, I think if nothing else, we have provided a fair and balanced look at the issues today. So, we want to thank all of you for joining us today, and we hope to have you back as our own version of Trump Watch continues here down the road.
You can get more information about Renato Mariotti's practice at thompsoncoburn.com. That is thompsoncoburn.com. For more information about Patrick Cotter, go to Greensfelder, Hemker, and Gale's website, greensfelder.com. And finally, find more information about Andrew DeVote at loeb.com. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Sounds great. Thanks for having us.
Very much. Thank you.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Faceoff. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Here in studio, our next guest is the Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. Carolyn Shapiro joins us from the Chicago Kent College of Law. Welcome to the show, Professor.
My pleasure.
Awesome. And then we have Rich. Go ahead and take it away.
So, Professor, you're a repeat guest on Legal Faceoff. Thanks for being here. On Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that Republicans in North Carolina unlawfully took race into consideration when drawing congressional district boundaries. Concentrating black voters what they called an improper bid to diminish their statewide political clout. Talk to us about that decision, if you can. You're the former Solicitor General of Illinois. You've argued cases before the Supreme Court. You're a former clerk in the Supreme Court. Tell us what you think of this decision.
Well, this decision is, I think, potentially pretty important, and it has a kind of an interesting history, which is that this claim that race is improperly taken into account in redistricting was a claim that was actually originally brought by voters, generally by white voters, who were unhappy about being districted in majority-minority district. And the Supreme Court started recognizing these kinds of claims in the 1990s. But now the same legal principles are being used by African-American voters who are claiming that they are being what's called packed. And the problem with packing is that it actually dilutes the overall influence of the vote of whatever group you're trying to pack, because you put more people in a particular district than necessary for them to have influence. Packing or not, it doesn't matter. The Supreme Court's jurisprudence is clear that taking race into account as the predominant factor in redistricting is unconstitutional.
Now, of interest was the way that Justice Thomas voted in this case. He voted with the four justices who are considered more liberal members of the court. Justice Thomas has always voted against race-based gerrymandering. Were you surprised by the way he voted in this case?
Well, I'm not surprised. Once I sort of read the opinion, read his separate opinion, and went back and looked at some of what he's written about in the past, because he is very consistent in his belief that race has no role to play at all in government decision making. So for that reason, he's actually been fairly hostile to claims brought under the Voting Rights Act or to claims that the Voting Rights Act and the requirements of the Voting Rights Act should allow government-based decision makers to take race into account, which is a claim that actually most of the rest of the court accepts. So here, where there is a determination that there was race-based decision making, it doesn't really surprise me that he would say that's no good.
So where do you think these districts go from here? I mean, now that it has been struck down, what effect does that have on the districts and the representatives?
Well, there will have to be some kind of remedy phase, which I don't believe there has been yet in this case, although there'll be a determination about how to go forward, whether with drawing your district, whether it's the legislature or the court. And then there may have to be a special election. There's not a lot of time left for these districts. There'll be regular elections again for these districts in 2018 and 2020, but then they have to be redistricted again anyway after the 2020 census. But the principles that the court has laid out will have to be taken into account in both the remedy in this case and also in the post 2020 redistricting. And the principles are really important because in places like North Carolina, where this case is from, race and party are just intertwined. What the Republicans here said is, we weren't thinking about race, we were thinking about party. We were just trying to draw the best map for us as Republicans. And so we just wanted to put all the Democratic voters in one district so that they wouldn't be voting against us in other districts. But where the Democratic voters are overwhelmingly African-American, as they are in this part of North Carolina, drawing that distinction is not necessarily very meaningful. And so this gives voting rights advocates at least a very clear argument that they can make if they want to challenge districts.
Professor Carolyn Shapiro, who, by the way, is a repeat guest on Legal Faceoff, who is the founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, who blogs at iSCOTUS now, who's all around the Supreme Court expert that we rely on this show. Let's pivot and talk about another case decided by the Supreme Court, this one dealing with patent trolls. The court made it harder for plaintiffs to file in what they consider plaintiff-friendly courts. Instead of filing a patent case anywhere where a company does business, like Google or Apple, the court ruled that you have to file the suit in the venue that the company does business. This is good news for companies like Apple and Google, who are being sued disproportionately in places like East Texas, making it harder to find juries that, you know, might know about their kind of case or be friendlier to them. So that's good news for companies like Apple and Google, right?
Yeah, they certainly think so. There has been this extremely unusual ability for plaintiffs in these patent cases to do what's called a forum shop, to choose the venue that they think is going to be friendliest to them. And in fact, there's something like 40% of all patent cases have been brought in one place in Texas. 25% of all patent cases are in one courtroom in front of one judge. That's very unusual and certainly suggests that the plaintiffs see something particularly advantageous to being there. And that's not the kind of game playing is not something that courts generally like. So this will definitely require plaintiffs to it will restrict where they can file, and I think therefore they're likely to be filing in places that are more attractive for the defendants in these cases. Some people say that a lot of these cases are brought by what are called patent trolls. Patent trolls are sort of known as people or corporations that own patents but aren't actually producing anything with them. They are using the patents that they've owned in order to seek royalties or get damages in an enforcement action. And sometimes those patents, you know, there's disagreements about how good those patents really are. So having a different set of courts looking at these cases may change the way that kind of litigation goes forward.
Professor Spiro, last question here on Legal Face-Off. We'll let you go, and we really appreciate your time. You were a clerk for Justice Stephen Breyer on the Supreme Court. I was sworn in last week in the United States Supreme Court. I finally took the ceremonial swearing in organized by my law school. Thank you. And we actually heard a decision that Justice Breyer read. And I'll have to tell you, you probably know this, but he was really very humorous in the way he read this case. It was a case that involved some technical some language, and he clearly understood that it was too technical for the room, and he made a little joke about that. And he, you know, I was really impressed with the way he read it and the humor in which he, you know, read a somewhat dry opinion. But it was obviously incredibly thrilling to be in that room and to be in front of seven of the nine justices. Justice Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch were not present, but what an experience, and one that obviously you experienced many times while clerking there.
Yeah, it's an amazing room, and it's definitely awe-inspiring to be in front of those justices.
And you can get more information about Carolyn Shapiro at the Chicago Kent College of Law. That's kentlaw.itt.edu. Thank you once again for being here, Professor.
My pleasure.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
And moving right along on Legal Face-Off, Rich Lenkov in studio here. We are now going to be joined by the Assistant Vice President for Amerisure Insurance, Kimberly Vaughn. Kimberly, nice to have you in studio.
Thanks for having me.
High atop Michigan Avenue in the world-famous WGN
yes.
Legal Face-Off Studios. We have Kimberly Vaughn. Kimberly, as Craig said, thanks for joining us. We're going to talk today about managing the opioid epidemic, which is a topic that you're very familiar with in your practice, but also because you and I discussed that in the forum column in the spring edition of the WC magazine, Workers' Compensation Magazine for Business Insurance. Yes?
That's correct.
Absolutely. You are representing your panel here today, so we thank you. So tell us from your perspective, having managed, handled workers' compensation claims for a number of years. Why is opioid use and abuse the epidemic that it currently is? What do you think about that?
Well, I think the main reason that it gets so much attention is the fact that it really is a public health crisis, because it's not just in work comp. In general, in this country, we're seeing an uptick in the number of people being prescribed opioid medication in order to manage their pain. And those drugs have significant impact on somebody's life. Certainly, we don't want someone to be in pain, but we also want them to try to relieve their pain in a safe way. And unfortunately, I think that chronic opioid use certainly has negative impacts on a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And so I think that's why it's getting the attention it's getting.
So if we all agree that it's an epidemic and it's a problem and people are using or are addicted to it and overusing it, why do you think doctors continue to prescribe opioid medications?
I think there's probably a number of reasons why. First of all, I think that certainly opioids do work in certain circumstances. I think particularly in an acute pain experience, you do see a lot of positive relief and positive results from using opioids. The issue is making sure that you can avoid chronic use where possible. And sometimes doctors will put their patients on drugs and unfortunately don't have a plan to wean those individuals. And when that happens, then you end up in a situation where the person has gotten pain relief, is maybe very worried or scared about stopping taking the opioids because they're worried about their pain coming back. I think that people are more aware of drugs that are out there with advertising and things of that nature. And so I think more patients probably ask for specific things than they did historically. And I think probably to some degree it has to do with the pharmaceutical industry and their advertising and their pushing of certain drugs to doctors and trying to convince them that they are, in fact, the best option for a given circumstance.
It's also easier. I agree with everything you said, and it's easier than ever to get these drugs, both legally and illegally. There's a huge market on the aftermarket for these drugs. They're cheap, they're easy to obtain. You don't have to go through a doctor, unfortunately. So that leads to a lot of abuse. We see as handlers of workers' compensation claims, lots of medical bills. They seem to be spiraling out of control on many claims. You and I are charged with controlling those costs while also meeting our duty to the injured employee to get them better and back to work. Before the Illinois legislature right now, as recently as today, they're talking about further reducing medical costs and fees in Illinois. They reduced them a few years ago by 30%, but they're still, I think, third most in the country. Opioid use and abuse is certainly a big portion of that. As a carrier, what are things that you think we can do on the defense side to continue to control costs of opioid medicines and other medical costs?
I think there are probably a number of things that can be done. First and foremost, it's really making sure that all the players, say in a work comp case, for example, understand what the injury is and where the pain is really coming from. There are actually conflicting studies that say, some say that opioids are really great with nerve pain and others say that it's not. And certainly we know that it does good things with muscular pain and things that are more orthopedic in nature. But when you have somebody who has potentially nerve damage from, say, a crush injury, for example, I think it's really up to the treater. It's up to the claimant's attorney. It's up to the insurance company. It's up to the nurse case manager. It's up to the defense attorney to think really hard about what is the best approach in treating that patient. Because, again, we do not want people to be in pain. But we want people to be treated safely with the best medicine available on the market for their pain. And also there are additional opportunities that we have with kind of alternative treatments, biofeedback, things of that nature, which for some people has been very successful. And so it's just really making sure that you're kind of attacking it from all sides instead of saying, well, this is the only way we know how to fix it. Here's a script. Go ahead and, go take this medicine for the foreseeable future.
In the article, we talk about some red flags that we on the defense side look for in terms of claimants potentially abusing opioids. What are some things that you look for when overseeing claims in terms of potential abuse of opioids?
One of the big flags, of course, is that a lot of doctors in a lot of states, their protocol for patients that are prescribed narcotic is to have urinalysis done on a regular basis to actually ensure that the medicine is being taken and that it's also not being taken in combination with other medications that may be contraindicated. So in that regard, when you have somebody with a urinalysis and it comes back clean and they don't even have the narcotic in their blood that they're supposed to be taking, that's certainly a red flag. It indicates, I don't know, I mean, potentially the person could be selling the drugs or giving them to a family member. That's a big red flag. Another red flag is for somebody who, despite increases in the dosages, does not experience any pain relief. And so it really begs the question that should they be having more of this, more and more of this drug in their body when it's not providing them any benefit? And so doctors, I think, should probably keep a very close eye on that to make sure that they're not giving their patient more medication than really is even helping them.
In the article, again, we talk about, we ask you and your fellow panelists, what should workers' compensation professionals do differently? A lot of us are in town this week for the CLM Workers' Compensation and Business Insurance Conference. Some of your fellow panelists talked about, for example, we did allow a plaintiff's attorney on the panel. Somehow we let Dave Manchetti in.
Dave's a great guy.
Great guy, great lawyer. He's been on our show many times. But he said, you know, management was the key. Utilization review can be very effective, something that we use frequently. Rosemary Quinones, who is with G4S North America, she said that improving safety programs and educating employees on the risks would be a good avenue. You, in the article, talked about the fact that we need to continue to have conversations. It can't just be about money. And that sometimes it takes a village to manage these kind of claims. What did you mean by that?
excuse me. It goes back to kind of what I said a minute ago about the fact that, you know, the claimant has to be involved, the treater, the insurance carrier, the defense attorney, the claimant's attorney, making sure that everybody's on the same page and that everyone has the same goal. And that goal should be, of course, the best pain relief available for a claimant with chronic pain, with as little intervention as possible in order to help them live a happy and productive life. So there are times when those are not in line, where they're not everyone in, working on a case feels the same way. Certainly in the case, say, example of Dave Manchetti, he's an excellent claimant's attorney, and I know that he cares very much about his clients. But there are attorneys out there who don't maybe care as much about their clients or have other interests beyond, you know, seeing them return to the best state of health possible. And so you have to keep an eye on that. You have to keep an eye on insurance companies, making sure that they're paying claims that are genuinely compensable claims and that they are using the lost dollars that they pay out on claims in the best way to most efficiently and effectively manage any medical condition, whether it's chronic pain or otherwise.
Kimberly, with the last minute we have with you on Legal Face-Off, you're a Michigan person, right? You're a double Spartan.
I am a double Spartan.
You went to law school undergrad at Michigan State. You work for a Michigan-based company. Amerisher is based in Farmington Hills. You now work in the Amerisher office here in Chicago. Question is, do you divide your loyalties between Detroit, Michigan sports teams, or have you adopted our local teams here in Chicago?
Well, I actually still work in the Farmington Hills office and live in Michigan.
Sounds like we're going down the wrong path
yeah.
here. Okay.
But I lived in Chicago, in Chicago, Lincoln Park and Lakeview for 7 years while I lived here and I practiced law. And I have to tell you, you know, if I'm honest, I say that I'm not a whole big sports fan at all. I certainly am a Spartan fan, right? Because I went to school there. When I did live in Chicago, I spent a lot of time going to games. I went to both Sox game and Cubs game. I know that's probably naughty or something.
I don't think anymore. I think the stigma
think
of like
okay,
North
yeah.
side and South side is gone.
It's way better than being a fan of Michigan teams.
We could all agree on that.
Well, no, there are a lot of great sports teams in Chicago, and you guys are lucky to have this wonderful city. I miss it a lot. Matter of fact, every time I come to town, there's a little pang that I'm like, oh, I miss it so much. I miss the streets and the buses and the L, and it's great. My
well,
time
you lived
here
in Lincoln
wonderful.
Park through the lean years of the Cubs and you know, miss the really exciting times.
That's right. They just started doing really well after I left. So hopefully that wasn't my fault. I guess I'm less than 108 years old, right? So it couldn't have been all me.
And remember to check out the forum article as well as Amerisure.com for anything more from Kimberly. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kimberly.
Thanks for having me.
And now we move on to the legal grab bag on Legal Face Off. And Rich, it's just you and I.
Just you and me. No, no Sam today. No Jason. They're taking the week off. So.
Yeah, that's well, okay. So the first story
more
on the agenda.
More fun for us.
We get to do the Trump Watch all by ourselves.
Trump Watch.
The first story on the agenda is Trump plagiarizing a speech from Legally Blonde, which is a very interesting choice for the
maybe
president
not the most serious story, but. Yeah, Jimmy Fallon did a mashup last right. week showing the Trump speech to Liberty University, and he showed how that was very similar to the famous legal address by Elle Woods, otherwise known as Reese Witherspoon, in Legally Blonde. Remarkably similar speeches. Not to say that Donald is not very original, but
correct.
If you look at the two speeches, they were remarkably similar.
Do you have any thoughts on Legally Blonde? Do you have any from a legal perspective?
I'm a big Legally Blonde fan. I think she was one of the foremost.
Me too.
Legal characters in cinematic history. This is on the heels of Trump also apparently plagiarizing from Bane. The
Batman
the
character?
The Batman villain earlier in the campaign.
He should do it in the Bane voice, if at least he does it.
That's when I decided that it's time to die. Did you ever see the...
I was born in the dark. You simply adopted it.
Mark Hamill doing Joker reading Trump quotes?
No.
So you know Mark Hamill does the Joker voice for years and years.
For sure. I've heard about these. These are really, and they're just
so funny. He would like just read straight up Trump quotes like, this is to all my enemies, but like as the Joker voice.
Yeah, they're like tweets and stuff too, right?
It's just amazing.
That's
stuff.
It. Well, and you said one character. Now we go to another legal character who's a real person. Anthony Weiner has pled guilty to yet another incident.
Yeah, Anthony Weiner was the former congressman, ran for mayor of New York, mm-hmm. and of course most famously known for texting minors, or I should say sexting minors, and he finally pled guilty in a New York court late last week. This was, of course, also involving his wife. This was all caught up in the Hillary email scandal. His wife is Uma Abedin, who is Hillary's chief aide. And it's expected that even though he admitted liability and even though he said that he has a sickness, the court will sentence him to up to 27 months in jail. So, the end of the road for Anthony Weiner, hopefully. And on the same day that he pled guilty, his wife served him with divorce papers. So probably about time for most people that she rid himself.
Yeah, I feel like, that was a little, that was long overdue.
It was the biggest.
It's like the Tiger Woods situation when you find out.
Exactly.
So Kit Kat, they lost their bid to a copyright on the Four Finger Chocolate Bar. How is that? How did they not have this?
So, a court in England ruled that the four finger shape of the Kit Kat bar that we all know and love is not distinctive enough to warrant a trademark.
Wow.
They have tried four separate times, Nestle has, to trademark the candy bar, and the courts have ruled over the course of a couple of almost a decade that it didn't meet the standard to warrant a European Union-wide trademark protection. I mean, to your point, I think everyone knows the four fingers is pretty distinctive to Kit Kat, but they didn't meet the legal requirements in this case.
Break me off a piece of your Kit Kat bar.
Exactly. Give me a break.
Alan Thicke's sons are taking on his widow in court over the estate. It's sad when you see stuff like this happen, when family is fighting family.
Yeah, pretty common. I mean, we've covered these kind of stories extensively on Legal Face Off. It's not uncommon when a celebrity, especially one with a sizable estate, dies to have his family fight over his estate. We've covered the Casey Kasem, very sad story extensively. In this case, Alan Thicke, who died at 69 after playing hockey, he died of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. His wife, who's a Bolivian-born actress, is insisting that the prenup that she signed just before they got married in 2005 is not valid.
Wow.
And she's entitled to a larger share of the estate. I think the kids got 2/3 and she was getting 25% according to the prenup. And she wants to argue that she should receive more. He has a life insurance policy. He has a large estate. He has some effects. So, yeah, sadly, this is ending up in probate court.
Wow. We move on to a Chicago law firm that has laid off 40 lawyers. I don't know if you're hiring at all, Rich, but it seems like you have a lot more opportunities now out there.
Yeah, fairly sizable firm, Seyfarth Shaw, just a couple of days ago announced that they're laying off 40 lawyers and also some staff members. They are headquartered at Willis Tower. They're headquartered here in Chicago, but they have 13 offices across the country, and the spokesman of the firm said that this is as a result of changing legal needs. In reality, the marketplace, both in Chicago and nationwide, is changing such that there's just a lot less work for law firms.
Wow.
A lot of our clients are taking work in-house. So, you know, these kind of staffing moves are not uncommon. Again, this is a fairly sizable firm. They have 847 lawyers. They bring in almost $650 million in revenue. So
yeah.
Anytime a firm that size has sizable layoffs, it sort of reverberates across the market.
40 sounds like a lot for lawyers. We move on to the last story. Starbucks customer is awarded. This doesn't make any sense to me as I'm reading this title, because didn't this happen at a McDonald's years ago? And then there was some, this was never going to happen again.
Yeah, the famous hot coffee case
for
McDonald's from years ago that we all heard about. There's a documentary about it.
Mm-hmm.
Another customer, this time from Starbucks, last week in Jacksonville was awarded $100,000to a woman who claimed she was severely burned when the lid popped off her Starbucks coffee. She had received it through a drive-thru window. And, you know, she alleged that this was indicative of Starbucks' habit of failing to properly seal the coffee, properly failing to put the lid on it, and the coffee being too hot. Again, as a defense lawyer who defends against lots of frivolous claims,
sure,
coffee is hot, right? Newsflash.
Yeah.
But apparently through discovery, Starbucks acknowledged that they get about 80 complaints a month about lids popping off. So the important part about that fact is that that goes to notice. If the company is aware, as the plaintiff in this case alleged, that this is a habitual problem,
mm-hmm.
and they don't do something to remedy it, that's good evidence that plaintiffs, like in this case, use to get money from companies. So
wow.
It wasn't so much a hot coffee situation as much as a defective product.
Yeah, and there was no Reese Witherspoon to defend anyone.
Unfortunately.
Or help out. Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, favorite Reese movie?
It might be Legally Blonde.
Blonde.
I think that is a decent movie. She's got some good ones early on, but they're not really Reese Witherspoon movies.
I like the early movie called Fear with Marky Mark. It was one of Marky Mark's first movies.
Yeah.
And she played, he was like an obsessive stalker.
Right.
And
they date, though, at first.
They
and
date,
then,
yeah, and then it all goes wrong when mm-hmm. Marky Mark finds out about some other
That is a good
secrets.
One, too. All right. So this has been Legal Face Off with
it.
A very sad, lonely kind of studio. But it's, you know, I had a good time. Rich, did you have a good time?
I did always.
All right. Awesome. Come back next week. Sam Panionovich for sure will be here. We'll get everybody back. It's going to be great.